Public radio is here for you. It doesn't matter how old you are, how big your home is, or what kind of car you drive. WOSU and NPR connect you to news and information in civil conversations. That's why 43 million Americans listen to NPR each week. WOSU is part of our community, covering and discussing issues important to you, standing with the facts. Meet the moment with WOSU. Go to WOSU.org/protect.
Welcome to All Sides with Amy Jarovich. ADHD in children and adults has skyrocketed since the 1990s. Last year, a record high of 11.4% of American children have been diagnosed with ADHD. That's almost 7 million children. The preferred treatment for ADHD remains stimulant medications, including Ritalin and Adderall. Even with all these diagnoses, are we looking at ADHD completely wrong? With some researchers claiming that we understand ADHD even less than we have in the past, what are we doing to tackle ADHD and are we doing it correctly? Paul Tough is a contributing writer for the New York Times Magazine, who for the last two decades has written articles and books about education and child development. He spent a year interviewing ADHD scientists around the world for his recent magazine cover story titled, "Have We Been Thinking About ADHD All Wrong?" Welcome to All Sides, Paul.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Now, you've been investigating attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, ADHD, and the medications used to treat it for years now. And I guess I want to ask you the sweeping question that is the title of your story. Have we been thinking about it all wrong?
I think some of us have. Yeah. I mean, I think it is a moment of real change in the field, but that change is kind of below the surface. I think there are certain assumptions that a lot of us have, both families who are dealing with it up close, but also people who are just sort of seeing it from a distance about what ADHD means. And when I spoke to the scientists, neuroscientists, and psychiatrists who are studying this, I found that they often had a very different interpretation.
So tell me about how research into ADHD has changed in the past 30 to 40 years. I mean, there's been more studies recently than we had back in the 90s. Is research overall getting better? Is better the right word?
It's a good question. I mean, I think it's getting better in that we are sort of less certain about things. But I think that in some ways is progress. So I wrote about two different sets of research. One has to do with the medications, with the stimulant medications. And the big study there is one that actually started in the 1990s, a randomized controlled study that has now gone for decades and has revealed some really useful information, I think, about those stimulants. But the other side of the research is about sort of the definition of ADHD, like how we talk about it, how we know when someone has it or they don't. And a lot of what that research is pointing towards is that this definition, which I think a lot of us tend to think of as just sort of a straightforward medical disorder that we can clearly know, does someone have it, does someone not have it? In fact, is much more fluid, that ADHD symptoms exist on a continuum. There's a lot of overlap between ADHD symptoms and symptoms of other disorders. And there is no really clear boundary where we can just say that person has ADHD and that person does not. Now, that does not mean that ADHD is you know, made up or not real, or that the experiences that people are having when they're diagnosed with ADHD and when they're experiencing these symptoms are not real and distressing and impairing in all kinds of ways. But it does mean that the way we think about it maybe needs to change, and that when we change that thinking, when we stop thinking of it as this sort of binary yes or no disorder, and instead think of it as a condition that exists on a continuum that might have as much to do with sort of a misalignment between an individual's brain and the environment that they're in, I think we can actually get to better treatments and a better sort of cultural understanding of what this disorder is and how to help people who are experiencing it.
Now, according to the CDC, 7 million American children have received an ADHD diagnosis. That's up from 6 million in 2016, and it was about 2 million in the mid-90s. So this increase in numbers, is it easier to diagnose, or just are more kids being tested? Is it something else?
Well, we don't know. That's the thing about this increase. There are lots of different interpretations. There are some folks, especially advocates, who say that it's about, we're just better. We understand it better, especially we're better at spotting it in demographic groups that were often underdiagnosed in the past, especially girls. In the past, it's been thought of as something that affected boys much more than girls. And so there are lots of folks who say that basically what's happening is we're catching up with reality, that we were missing lots of cases in the past, and now we're getting them. There are others who are more skeptical that all of these diagnoses are accurate, who say that there's a lot of pressure to diagnose ADHD. That pressure sometimes comes from individuals, it comes from families, that because stimulant medication is effective for a lot of families and helps usually with behavior in the classroom, there's an urge among teachers, among some clinicians, and among parents to say, like, we just want to know a clear answer to what's going on with our kid. And that often means an ADHD diagnosis and a stimulant medication prescription.
Mm. Can you tell me the difference between ADD, attention deficit disorder, and then adding the H in, ADHD, adding the, are they considered mostly the same now?
They are. So ADHD is the current term for this disorder that over the last few decades, we've had lots of different terms for it. Mm-hmm. I spoke to one of the scientists who I wrote about in this paper, was diagnosed himself back in the 1970s. For him, it was called hyperactivity and minimal brain dysfunction. Mm-hmm. Then it was called attention deficit disorder. And then there's always been this tension between these different forms, one of which involves hyperactivity, and the current term includes hyperactivity in its name.
Now, in your piece that you wrote for New York Times Magazine, you talked about how ADHD used an example, basically, that ADHD is not like diabetes, which has a biomarker. You do a blood test, you know you have diabetes, you know how bad it is because of the blood test, but ADHD is not like that. Are there other mental health disorders that do have a biomarker, or is this a problem beyond ADHD?
It's a problem beyond ADHD. The search for a biomarker, I wrote about it quite a bit in this article, and I found it really fascinating in some ways because, like mostly with psychiatric disorders, there is not a clear biomarker. But about 20 years ago, there was this real push in the field to find one, to find like the one gene that always predicted ADHD, or to find differences in the cortical volume, the size of different parts of the brain, or electrical waves that look different. And I think that came from this sort of anxiety, I think, that a lot in the field feel that lots of people are very skeptical about ADHD and have been for decades, since before it was called ADHD. There are people who I think often very unhelpfully think, you know, this is just being a rambunctious kid. Like, yeah, I have trouble focusing too. And they don't recognize that for some children and for some adults as well, these symptoms can be really intense and really impairing. And so I think to kind of defend the diagnosis against those skeptics, there was this push to say, let's find the one biological signature that is always true of people who have ADHD. And then not only will it make it easier for us to diagnose, but we will have proven that this is a real disorder. And over the last 20 years, the search for a clear biomarker has gone further away from reality. A lot of the hopes that were there 20 years ago have faltered, and there's still people who are searching for a clear biomarker, mm-hmm. but most scientists, I think, have moved away from that search and are saying, it's not necessary to find one biological signature to know that this is a real disorder.
This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about ADHD with Paul Tough, a contributing writer for the New York Times Magazine. He recently wrote a cover story titled, Have We Been Thinking About ADHD All Wrong? Now, the current tool used to diagnose this is a two-part test where there's 9 symptoms that are tested for inattention and then 9 for hyperactivity. And you have to test positive in at least 6 in both categories. Do you feel like, from talking to people, is this a good test?
Well, so this is, you're using the word test, which I understand why you're saying this, but it's really just interpretation by a clinician who is looking at a patient, let's say a child, and is talking to them, is interviewing them, is interviewing parents, is interviewing teachers, and looking for these symptoms, things like they fidget, they can't sit still, they speak out of turn, they don't answer when they're spoken to. And they're trying to identify how many of these symptoms this child has. They also need to find them in two different settings. They need to have been a problem for at least 6 months, and they need to have hit a sort of level of impairment. So in some ways, that's not a bad checklist, right? Mm-hmm. The thing about it is it's open to interpretation. There is a lot of subjectivity in identifying this, and good clinicians can use that subjectivity really well. But it also means that the attempt to define ADHD as this sort of clear disorder like diabetes, where we just know you've got diabetes, you don't, we can do a test to say whether it's there or not. It doesn't work that way when it comes to ADHD. And so where a lot of the scientists who I'm writing about are going is saying that if the boundaries of ADHD are not as clear as we thought they were, maybe that means that we should think differently about how we diagnose it and how we treat it.
Hmm. Were you learning in your talking to so many people you talked to for this piece, did you learn more that is you're going to use the word testing again, but sure. Seeing a clinician to figure out things about ADHD, yeah. Is that coming mainly from parents or from teachers, or is it always both?
I think it's both. I think often, and I think it depends on the level of impairment. So I mm-hmm. think if you've got a child who is severely impaired with ADHD symptoms, you know, right? Like, yeah. You know from pretty early on. But I think there's also there are some kids who are functioning really well at home, but are struggling to fit into a school environment. And then I think any teacher can tell you that's really disruptive for the rest of the class. And so I think there are some instances where a teacher will say to a parent, please get this kid tested, figure out whether that's what's going on. And I think those instances are often particularly confusing for parents and can be a challenge for clinicians who are trying to diagnose as well.
Did you come across particular age groups? Is it normally in the middle of elementary school, or does it happen more diagnoses in middle school, high school? I mean, I don't know that it would happen even younger in the preschool era. Does it just depend on each child?
Yeah, I think it does. I mean, I think there are certainly kids who have the symptoms early on, as early as pre-K or kindergarten. In a lot of cases, I think it's hard at that age to distinguish between some of those symptoms and just the natural rambunctiousness of kids. My sense is that the period where it tends to be diagnosed the most is sort of in you know, second, third, and fourth grade, like 7 and 9 year olds. But I also spoke to some teenagers who had been diagnosed in high school, who at that age were struggling with school in a new kind of way and sought out a diagnosis. And then my article is mostly about children diagnosed with ADHD. But one of the things that's very clear in the data is that the demographic in which there is the fastest growth, both in diagnoses and in stimulant medication treatment, is adults. Mm-hmm. So the percentage of diagnoses and treatment in people in their 20s and 30s is really skyrocketing right now. The child rates have tended to grow pretty steadily for the last few decades. It's adults where we're seeing a lot of new diagnoses.
Do you know if in those adults, do they think they had it all along? They had ADHD maybe in elementary school, high school, or can you? Have you found people grow into it? I don't, that's a weird phrase, but yeah.
Yeah. So I didn't write about adult ADHD mm-hmm. and I know less about it, but I certainly have spoken to lots of people who have had this experience. And in order to be diagnosed with adult ADHD, you need to have had the symptoms as a child. Mm-hmm. But a lot of people, as they look back on their childhood, they were like, well, that was what was going on. I wasn't diagnosed when I was in second grade, when I was bouncing off the walls, but now I think that's what's going on. I think sometimes that's really helpful that you can correct a missed diagnosis in childhood. I think it's also, though, possible that as you as adult patients are sort of rethinking their childhood, that they can kind of put their childhood experiences into a more narrow box than it should be. I think there's a tendency to say, oh, that's what was going on for my whole life. When in fact, you know, childhood is complicated. And I think there are lots of adults who are experiencing a new kind of distress that is getting diagnosed as ADHD.
Coming up, Paul Tuff is staying with us, and we're going to be discussing a little more about the medication used to treat ADHD in children. We'll talk about that in more detail in just a moment. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Planet Money helps you understand the economy. We find the people at the center of the story.
Garbage in New York, that was like a controlled substance.
We show you how money influences everything.
Tell me what you like by telling me how you spend your money.
And we dig until we get answers.
I had a bad feeling you were going to bring that up.
Planet Money finds out. All you have to do is listen. The Planet Money podcast from NPR.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Amy Jarovich. For decades, Adderall and Ritalin have been the go-to fix for ADHD children in ADHD in children and adults. But with more and more reports of its ineffectiveness in actual academic and scholastic merit, is there a better approach to this drug? With kids even choosing to stop taking the pills, is the solution to ADHD more environmental and less about medication? Still with us is Paul Tuff, a contributing writer for the New York Times Magazine, who for the last two decades has written articles and books about education and child development. He recently wrote the cover story titled, Have We Been Thinking About ADHD All Wrong? Thanks again for being with us today, Paul.
Thank you.
So when talking about ADHD, it's hard to avoid a conversation about Adderall and Ritalin and other medications that are meant to fix attention disorders. Can you tell me how these drugs work? What do they do in the brain to help?
Well, I think the actual like chemical process that is going on is not always clear. But mm-hmm. but what I hear from people who tell me about their experiences in taking it helps them focus on the stuff that they need to focus on that is sometimes not particularly interesting. So both of those medications, both Adderall and Ritalin, are based on amphetamines. I mean, Adderall is sort of an amphetamine salt. Ritalin is a little bit different, but is based chemically really quite similar. And amphetamines are things that, you know, Americans have a long history with, going back decades. And they've been used in our culture at moments where people need to deal with really boring stuff. So the Defense Department back in World War II gave amphetamine pills to soldiers who had to, you know, stay up all night looking for German planes to keep them focused. And that's often how it's described, its effect in the brain. It helps to get rid of the appeal of distractions and keeps you focused on the thing that you're supposed to be focused on.
Now, you highlight in your article that sometimes kids take this medication every day. Sometimes they have to take more than one dose. And then sometimes it's found to be more useful in a situationally, right? That if they need to focus on a test or a big project, then they can take it like that. Is that the clinical, like, do doctors approve of it being used in different ways by different people?
I think sort of not officially.
Yeah.
I think some doctors would suggest that it's okay to use it that way. You know, officially it is a daily medication, or sometimes more than once a day. that you're supposed to take all the time. It's considered a chronic medication. People take it for years. A lot of clinicians say it's something that you're going to take the rest of your life. There are certainly experiences where its effects fade, and there are clinicians who talk about sort of drug holidays of taking a week or two away from the medication in order to increase its potency again. So I would say different clinicians have different approaches to it, but generally, no, it's not supposed to be situational. It's supposed to be a chronic medication.
And you gave some examples of people taking Ritalin or Adderall in your article. And one that I found interesting was the idea of if you took it for a long time, then eventually it stops working, or are they just not seeing the same effects from it?
Yeah, so I think there's individual experiences that mm-hmm. are all over the map. So some people feel like it works forever. Some mm-hmm. people feel like they don't like it right away, and it's not working for them. But the data that we have on the long-term effect of this mostly comes from this one study that started back in the 1990s called the MTA study, this big randomized controlled study that was conducted in six sites across North America. And it compared Ritalin, which was the main stimulant treatment at the time, with behavioral interventions, a combination of the two, and then a fourth group that didn't get any particular types of treatment, that just figured out the treatment for themselves. And the first finding from this study was that after 14 months, there was a clear indication that for these children with ADHD, Ritalin was the most effective intervention for managing their symptoms. And so when that came out in the late 1990s, there was, I think, a real sense in the clinical world that this was the solution, that Ritalin was the way to go, that it works. But when the scientists continued to study those children, follow them over time, they discovered that the relative effectiveness of Ritalin faded over the next couple of years. And by 36 months, by 3 years into the experiment, there was no difference in the symptoms of any of the four groups, including the group that hadn't had any particular treatment at all. And so that led to, I think a lot of confusion on the part of those scientists who had sent out the word that this was a good long-term medication, and now we're really rethinking that.
Mm. And you mentioned that one of those groups in the study had behavioral interventions. Is this basically like talk therapy? Is it therapy to help? Is that what you mean by behavioral intervention?
Yeah, I would say it's a little bit different. So it tends to divide into interventions with parents. So sort of parent coaching, helping parents have different approaches to when their children are having intense symptoms, and then some version of therapy. Yeah, when we're talking about pretty young kids, it's not, it's not the sort of therapy of like, let's talk about your deep psychological issues. It's, I think in some ways it's closer to coaching. Like when you're having these impulses, when you're having trouble controlling these symptoms, what are some approaches that you can take?
One interesting thing that came out of one of the studies that you talked about in your article is that people who were on these medications for a really long time, for the most part, they all were an inch shorter than those who were not on it.
Yeah, that was the same study, the MTA study, that found these diminishing returns for Ritalin over 3 years and beyond. They also noticed in that first three-year or that second three-year study that the group that had taken Ritalin was about an inch shorter than the other groups. They assumed that that was just a temporary thing and that that would change as these kids got into adolescence. But then they continued to follow these children through adolescence and even into adulthood, and it didn't go away. So on average, the children who are now the adults who have taken medication consistently over the years since childhood remain about an inch shorter than those who started and stopped or who never took the medication at all.
And fascinating, because they don't really know why.
They're not quite sure. I mean, part of like one good theory is that Ritalin and Adderall have a big effect on appetite. You just aren't as hungry. This is what folks tell me after they take this pill. And so families often try to time it so that you eat a big breakfast, then you take your pill. You might skip lunch and then you are hungry again at dinner time. So one theory is that if that's happening throughout your childhood, you're just eating less, and so you're shorter. It's not clear, though. There are other theories that it has more to do with hormones, with other parts of development. All we know so far is that in this one study, it was a consistent average result.
This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about ADHD with Paul Tuff, a contributing writer for the New York Times Magazine, and he wrote the story titled, Have We Been Thinking About ADHD All Wrong? Another portion of your article talked about environmental factors, environmental changes, and how people saw improvements in their ADHD symptoms if they just basically were in a class they were interested in or took a job that they really liked, which that was interesting. Is that, I don't know that that's sustainable for every child across every part of their life, but what did you make of that?
Yeah, so it's you know, scientifically, it's harder to be certain about the effectiveness of those sorts of changes because, you know, we can't really do a randomized controlled study where we put half the kids in an interesting classroom and half in a less interesting classroom. Mm-hmm. But there are two studies, I think, that suggest that changes of it in environment might have a lot to do with changes in symptoms. One is another part of the MTA study found that these kids who were diagnosed, you know, at 7 and 8 and 9, that only about 11% of them had clinical levels of ADHD symptoms throughout their childhood and through adolescence. Mm-hmm. With most of them, the symptoms would sort of come and go. They would fluctuate over the course of their childhood and into adulthood, sometimes dipping below the cutoff that says we can diagnose you with ADHD, and sometimes returning and going back up above. And so that was a real sort of challenge to this idea that this is just a, you know, consistent brain-based disorder that you either have or you don't have. In fact, it seems like these fluctuations are much more common. And we don't know exactly why those fluctuations happen. But one theory from the person who did that study is that it has to do with the environment that you're in. And her guess was that when you're in stressful situations, your symptoms would tend to increase. But what she actually found is that it's the opposite, that being in a certain kind of challenging situation for a lot of these young people was actually good for their symptoms. Those were the periods where their symptoms were diminishing. And then another part of the study did sort of qualitative interviews, just talked to these young people when they were in their early 20s. And this was a moment where a lot of them had more control over their lives than they did as children and as adolescents, and were starting to make their own decisions about whether they would go to college, what they would study, what kind of jobs they would take. And they were making choices that were a better match with their brains, with their own sort of personalities and tendencies. And they often found that once they chose something that they really liked doing, that they found interesting, that their ADHD symptoms really diminished. And that changed their way of thinking about themselves, about their childhood. So no longer did they think of themselves as like having a defect in their brains. They instead thought, well, this is just something that was a mismatch between my brain and my environment. I found a better environment. My symptoms are diminished.
You talked with one of the leading people in ADHD research and diagnosing ADHD back in the 90s. And did you find that he was one of the people who said, like, Ritalin works, Adderall works. Did he have any regrets about that? Does he still feel it is the number one best way to help with this?
Yeah, so this is James Swanson, who was one of the original scientists who worked on the MTA study years and years ago. And he, I think, more than anyone else in that MTA study, is really rethinking a lot of those initial recommendations. He thinks it really matters that the long-term effectiveness is not at all clear. So I think he is among the bigger skeptics of long-term use of stimulant medication. I mean, so he, like most of the scientists I spoke to, said that in the short term, and if you look at you know, behavior rather than anything else, these medications can be really effective. A lot of families, a lot of individuals see really big effects almost overnight when kids start these medications. His point is that over the long term, they lose their effectiveness or become less effective, or their downsides outweigh their benefits. And so he thinks that we should be more skeptical about using these medications over the long term.
Did you ask him about the increases in diagnoses of ADHD? Does he feel like there's too many kids who are being diagnosed with it? Like, is he surprised by the increases, I guess?
He's surprised, yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think like a lot of people, he is cautious about saying there is overdiagnosis. Mm-hmm. I think he's skeptical about some of the diagnosis, but I think it's really hard to say. It's like, if we accept that ADHD symptoms are on a continuum, what is probably happening is that more and more people with milder symptoms are being diagnosed. That the kids who were really struggling, who had intense symptoms, we were catching them decades ago, and that the ones that we're finding now tend to have milder symptoms. And so anytime that that happens, and it's happened in lots of different disorders, it changes the nature of the group that is diagnosed, right? You're going to have more heterogeneity. You're going to have more variation. And there's going to be these fluctuations are going to be more intense as well. So whether that means that a lot of the people who are getting diagnosed shouldn't be diagnosed, that's not clear. Like, maybe we need a different name for the intense version and the less intense version. Though it's also true that people's symptoms change over time. All of those things, I think, are reasons for the rethinking that's going on in this field, trying to figure out a way to create a definition and a treatment plan that is the most helpful to the most people is a real challenge, I think, for the field right now.
Are there different expectations now than in, like, before ADHD became more and more diagnosed in the 90s? Were there different expectations for being able to sit and focus in school in the 70s and 80s? Do parents have different expectations? Is that why there's more kids being tested for this? Because schools now say, you know, you should be sitting still and focusing better.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like I don't know that scientifically, but it mm-hmm. certainly makes sense to me. And it's definitely what I've observed over my years of being an education reporter, and now as a parent as well, what I see. And, you know, there are researchers who've written about the way that childhood has changed. And I would say as well, there are ways that that adulthood has changed. So when I think about the growth in diagnoses among people in their 20s and 30s, you know, I think about how many jobs are now involved just sitting all day staring at a screen, at a laptop or a computer. And that wasn't true in the past. And that's certainly true for kids. I think there's less recess, there's less playing, free play outdoors, there's more of an academic focus for more and more kids. And I think it makes sense that there would be a lot of kids who are really struggling with that, who are not well suited for that approach. And that may be behind some of the rise in symptoms, both among children and among adults.
I wanted to end on, I was reading some of the comments on your piece in the New York Times. There were many, many comments, and many of them Yes. you responded to directly. Did any of the comments stand out to you? Did you find information in those comments and you're ready to write a whole nother piece?
I mean, one of the things I think that was really striking was, so I wrote again about children. We did not get a lot of children commenters, and that's, you know, because children don't tend to comment on stories in the New York Times. So I heard from a lot of parents, but I also heard from a lot of adults. And I think there is this question about how adult ADHD and childhood ADHD connect and compare and contrast that I definitely don't know the answer to, and I don't know that the field knows the answer to. But I heard from a lot of adults who were like, well, what you're describing is not my experience. Mm-hmm. And I think that's probably true, that a lot of what this research shows in children, whatever is happening in the growth in adult ADHD diagnoses is something different. Yeah, that's something I don't know the answer to. I'm curious about it, but it's a much harder field, I think, to understand and study scientifically, because we don't have the same kind of, you know, decades of data and, you know, long-term randomized controlled studies that we have with children. And so the answers to what is happening with this growth of diagnoses among adults, I think, are much more elusive.
That was Paul Tough, contributing writer for the New York Times Magazine, who for the last two decades has written articles and books about education and child development. Paul, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you very much.
And coming up, we're going to talk with someone who has worked with children and adults with ADHD in Central Ohio. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Planet Money helps you understand the economy. We find the people at the center of the story.
Garbage in New York, that was like a controlled substance.
We show you how money influences everything.
Tell me what you like by telling me how you spend your money.
And we dig until we get answers.
I had a bad feeling you're going to bring that up.
Planet Money finds out. All you have to do is listen. The Planet Money podcast from NPR.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. There are many new research developments in diagnosing and treating ADHD, but how are clinical psychologists adapting to the new information? Parents want their kids to do well in school, pay attention, to focus. Many kids want to be able to oblige, but are traditional medications the best fit for every child? We're joined by Dr. Kara Predmore, a clinical and forensic psychologist at Converge Psychological Services. She specializes in evaluating and treating individuals with ADHD. Thanks for joining us for All Sides, Dr. Predmore.
Glad to be here. And thanks for starting the conversation.
Yes. So we've spent the first part of the show talking about an article from New York Times Magazine that was basically titled, "Have We Been Thinking About ADHD All Wrong?" Do you agree with that premise? Do you feel like there's a lot of research happening now, and have we been thinking about it all wrong?
I have to say, I'm a bit of an optimist. And when I saw the title, I was optimistic. But, you know, shortly into the article, my optimism really faded. I don't think the article accurately captured, you know, the advances in research and understanding of the condition.
Okay. Well, then tell me about that. What part of the research and understanding of the condition do you pay the most attention to? What sort of, you just talk about some of the discrepancies you've noticed.
Oh, absolutely. I think the thing that really stood out to me that maybe the average reader wouldn't have known is what the article left out or what the article didn't say. It doesn't talk about the positive impact of ADHD treatment. It didn't talk about the reduce in risk across a number of areas related to treatment of ADHD. What it did do is it tended to present research findings in a very biased and inaccurate way that really upheld old myths and misconceptions we have about the diagnosis, and really invalidated the experiences of millions of individuals and their families who are living with this diagnosis.
So in your research, when you, or in your time, you know, working with people and diagnosing them with ADHD, is there a particular tool in the article? It was referenced that there's a 2-part test for 9 symptoms of inattention and 9 for hyperactivity, and you have to test positive in 6 of those. Is that how you diagnose ADHD?
There's not one particular tool to diagnose ADHD. It's using a constellation of tools. There's not a test like a medical examination. You can't, you know, check someone's blood or do an X-ray to see if someone has ADHD. It requires a thorough interview of the person and the person's family members. It requires, usually there's some rating scale data that are given to the individual if they're old enough to fill them out, or the family members and other people involved in the person's life. Maybe it's the teachers, maybe it is a partner or significant other who can give information about that person's behavior and how impaired it is, or how much they're having problems because of certain symptoms. And then there's also neurological testing that can be done to help kind of diagnose the condition. And sometimes some professionals use neuropsych testing in their diagnosis of the condition, and other professionals don't use neuropsych testing. I happen to use neuropsych testing when I'm doing an evaluation for the condition, but it's not black or white, simple. It's a very methodical approach that gets information from various sources.
Have you seen an uptick in the number of people coming to you wondering if their child has ADHD?
No. It's been about the same since I've been doing this. I have seen an uptick in adults. coming to me for an evaluation of attention deficit hyperactivity disorder.
Are you finding more adults do have it? If you, I mean, when
Yes.
everyone who comes in, everyone who comes in, do they have it?
Yes. Not everyone that comes in, but I do feel like a lot more adults are coming to me and wanting an evaluation. And in many of the cases, yes. And a diagnosis of ADHD does fit. And that does require like kind of like going backwards and saying, well, tell me about your childhood and really looking at some incidents and situations from their childhood to make that diagnosis.
Is for children who come to see you, is prescribing either Ritalin or Adderall or something of the like, is that the number one way that you choose to treat ADHD?
Well, I cannot, I'm a psychologist, so I can't prescribe
Oh, that's true.
medications.
Yes.
But I do, but I do offer that as a recommendation, as a possible treatment option if I have diagnosed their child with ADHD. And we talk about the risks and benefits of that treatment during a feedback session I have with the families. But we also talk about other treatment options available, including, behavioral training, cognitive behavioral therapy, treatment with other medications like non-stimulant medications or hypertensive medications. So it's not just a one treatment method. There's many options out there and available for the treatment of this condition.
Do you feel like, I don't know if most of the time is the right word, but most of the time, do people who t start taking a drug for it, do they see improvements? Do they see their ADHD being more under control?
Yes, a lot. It makes a big difference. Yes, I hear that a lot. I get that feedback a lot.
Do they tend to stay on it for a long time, or can it be a temporary fix?
Either or, it's what's nice about stimulant medication in particular is that it's pretty fast acting. It's fast in your system, it's fast out of your system. So you don't have to take it every day, like you might have to take an antidepressant medication. So when you know that it'll be helpful for you and it'll, you can take it in situations that you want to be at your best. And then maybe in situations where you don't need to be as focused or attentive or less impulsive, you don't have to take it, So there it comes with that. But we have found that for children especially, the more consistent it's taken, the better effect it has.
This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. I'm Amy Jurevich. We're talking with clinical and forensic psychologist Dr. Kara Predmore about her experience in ADHD testing and diagnosis and treatments. Do you find that in addition to the medications, is having, I guess, behavior, I can't remember what word you used, but basically like giving them strategies, giving the parents strategies, giving the kids themselves strategies to help them with their focus and attention. Does that help too?
Yes, absolutely. And it's not just behavioral training. So it's one of the components of behavioral training is education, right? We're really teaching the kid and the family members about the disorder, what it entails, how it might present differently in different situations and settings. That's a big part of behavioral training. And another part is offering accommodations in the person's environment, whether that's at home or school, to kind of support the fact that their brain works a little bit differently than most other, most kids their same age. And that can look like at school, having extra time to take tests or complete assignments. It can look like shorter assignments, not as long as maybe other kids in the classroom. So just ways to kind of support impairments they have rather than make those impairments make life more difficult for them.
Do you see a connection between the rising use of technology, both at home and in school, and attention issues in children?
That's an interesting question. Yes. Definitely a connection there, but when it comes to individuals with ADHD, I've seen a couple different responses. Some people, the just the nature of technology and the immediate feedback it gives you and the immediate kind of pleasurable experience, individuals with ADHD, are more prone to get sucked into that than your average individual. So I can see it be more problematic. And in other instances, I've seen teenagers especially who are just really turned off by technology and who re do really poorly when education is mostly across in a technological way and not in an in-person or hands-on fashion. So I think it just depends on the individual. But yeah, it can certainly technology does play a role in difficulties with attention.
Do you feel more children are being referred to you for a diagnosis from the teacher or the parent or both?
I feel like younger kiddos, a lot of times, the teacher has kind of said something, or maybe it's another family member to the parents that's kind of prompted the diagnosis. Not all the time. Some of the parents are very much aware, or the parent themselves has a history of being diagnosed with ADHD, so they are on top of it, and they want to make sure that their child is getting, the treatment that they need. But not all the time, yeah. So sometimes, yes, other people are encouraging the parents to have their child evaluated, and sometimes it's the parents who are kind of pushing for the evaluation.
Now, we talked in the previous segment about how there's no biomarker, there's no blood test to be able to say, like, yes, you have ADHD. The way, if you have diabetes, you do a blood test, you know you have it, you know how bad it is. Do you think that there is a genetic component out there or some sort of biomarker out there that hasn't been found for ADHD? Or do you think that it's very case by case and not a biomarker related?
Well, I think the research definitely shows that there's not a biomarker, but there's heritability, right? We know it runs in families. But there's not a clear biomarker. It seems to be very complicated. Some studies say there's up to 70 genes that are involved in the disorder. So it's very complicated. It's very nuanced. And trying to find a biomarker, is that where we should be putting our energy right now?
I guess by the way you said that, maybe not. Where should we be putting our energy?
Well, I really feel like we should be putting our energy into educating the public more about this diagnosis, especially after reading this article. I mean, personally, I grew up in the 80s and 90s, and I went to graduate school in the early 2000s. And I feel like I absorbed some of these messages that are still reverberating in this article, that stimulant medication is bad, that it doesn't really help, that kids can become addicted. And one of the first things I learned in graduate school about ADHD is that when it's treated, it significantly reduces the likelihood of the individual developing a substance use disorder. That's huge, like 60 to 70%. So that's a big deal. I mean, and the fact that we're not telling more people about that, I think, is a problem. The fact that more people don't know that treatment for ADHD significantly reduces the likelihood of car accidents, unplanned pregnancies, co-occurring anxiety and depression, incarceration, self-injury, suicide. I mean, the research really shows us that when ADHD is being treated properly, people live longer, they live healthier, they live safer lives. They're not experiencing more complications to their lives because they get in a car accident or they experience a head injury. And people with ADHD die earlier than people without diagnosed with the condition. So, I mean, I really feel like there's so many myths and misconceptions out there that just kind of hinder our ability to, treat ADHD and get people to the treatment they need and get people to buy into the treatment and, use the treatments consistently.
Do you feel like, well, there's more and more kids being diagnosed with it now than in the 90s. Do you feel like there's still the same stigma that you mentioned growing up in the 80s and 90s? Or, I mean, do you feel like it is improving until you read this article, I guess?
Yes. Yeah. Yes, exactly. I feel it and I see it in my practice. Reading this article really made me feel like, oh, maybe I need to take a step back. Maybe in my bubble, things are improving, but maybe in a bigger bubble, we're missing the mark here. I wanted to say something else about something that you said, but I can't remember what it was now. But the thing I wanted to say is, I think that's another thing this article does about these rising rates, right? Mm-hmm. I think it's important to point out that the rates that this article is referencing are based on the CDC, and the CDC is not a well-designed study for determining the rates of ADHD. You know, it only asks one question, and that's, have you ever been told by a doctor or healthcare professional that your child has ADHD or ADHD, ADD? That's it. That's all they're using to determine their rates. Mm-hmm. Whereas studies that look at, we're in the DSM, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, is being used to determine if the child or the individual fits the criteria for ADHD, the rates are much lower. They're closer to 3 to 5% for kids, or three for adults, 3 to 8% for children. So this idea of rising rates is a little misleading, I think. And it's also important to point out that in the 90s, 40 years ago, these rates were based purely on studies involving boys. Mm. You know, we're including girls, we're including women, we're including people of color when we're researching the condition now.
Okay, we're going to have to leave it there. But thank you so much for your time, Dr. Kara Predmore, clinical and forensic psychologist at Converge Psychological Services. Thank you for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News.